This is Tuesday, January 9th, 2007. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's Continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Joan Craig. Our cameraman today is Dan McDermott of Natick Pegasus, and we are privileged today to have Gerald Lee Halterman. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
May I ask you, when were you born?
March 13th, 1921.
And where were you born?
Carbondale, Illinois, southern part of Illinois.
And what is your current address?
Where is what?
Your current address?
30 Woodmere Road, Framingham, Massachusetts.
And are you married, single, widowed, or divorced?
My wife, Rosalie Sharp Halterman, from Wellesley Hills, that I married in October 1945 after separating from the service, died December the 14th, 1 year ago, from Alzheimer's, and is buried in the Bourne National Cemetery.
Thank you. I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have children?
I have three sons. The youngest being Down syndrome, Glenn. He's 45 now, this last November, and he has, to his credit, a hole-in-one in a golf tournament with $1,000 that he won, and because of him, he and I have been invited out to Las Vegas the last 7 years to play in the $1 million hole-in-one tournament out there.
Isn't that great? And does he live with you or around this area?
He lives in Longfellow Glen in Sudbury with a group of 11, and he has a male roommate. Mm-hmm. They've been there now 2 years.
And where did you go to high school?
Carbondale Community High School. Carbondale, Illinois, where I played football and received honorable mention for playing football because I was carried out with a broken leg.
During a game?
During the game on November the 11th, 1938.
You can remember the date?
Because it was Armistice Day.
It was Armistice Day.
Because my leg was broken.
And where and when did you enter the military?
I entered the military September the 8th, 1939.
Why did you join?
A couple of things, I think. For one thing, in April 1939, as a senior at the Carbondale Community High School, we were called into the assembly to listen to a speech on the radio by Hitler, and you never heard such a raving maniac in all your life. You knew then, or you had a feeling, that there were going to be some real consequences, and that if anybody could pull the world into war, he could, and he did.
Did your other classmates feel the same way?
Pardon?
Did your other classmates feel the same way?
I don't know as they did. I never really discussed it with them.
Did other classmates go into the service after graduation?
Yes, they did. I didn't keep very much track of it.
And what branch did you decide to go into?
Into the Navy.
Why?
I had a half-brother that served on the USS Houston back about 1936, somewhere along in there, and that was my first initiation to the Navy. Hindsight tells me that the Navy was the best place for me to go.
And when did you first start your when and where did you start your basic training?
We were sent out, instead of going to Great Lakes in Chicago, we were sent out to from St. Louis, Missouri, out to San Diego, California. Now, the training had been cut back from 3 months to 2 months. They were in a hurry to man the ships that they had because I think they sensed there was a need for it.
Because this was before the U.S. declared that they would go into the war, correct?
Yes.
What do you remember about basic training?
The basic training, I had a way of getting out of hard exercises. On the drill, the chaplain, he asked for volunteers to sing in his choir, and I did. So I'm singing while they're out there drilling in the hot sun.
And did you have a good voice?
I don't know. I thought I did until I got up to Amherst College after the war, and my wife talked me into climbing up the hill and trying out for the Amherst choir, and Professor Mishkin, he said, "You haven't sung in quite some time, have you?" So I got the message.
Did you receive any specialized training during or after basic training?
The most specialized training I got, which I think saved my life, was in high school, where I learned to type 38 words a minute. And that put me in a spot where later on, it turned out I typed a message at Pearl Harbor where they wanted a yeoman third class for shore duty. Instead of giving it to the Marine orderly to pass around, I turned to my commanding officer and said, "Could I have it?" And that was in April 1941.
Okay, before we get to April of 41.
Pardon?
Before we get to 41, let's talk a little bit more about leading up to that.
Okay.
What was your first duty station once you got out of any specialized training? Your first duty station?
My first duty station, I said the right thing in naval training. They wanted to know what I wanted to do. I said, "I want to go to the Naval Academy." So what did they do? They put me aboard the USS Oklahoma, a battleship, where they had a small class training for the admission to the Naval Academy.
And you were part of that class?
There were three of us aboard the USS Oklahoma. Yeah. Bob Mann, who went ashore in Long Beach, California, and married his childhood sweetheart, and that eliminated him. And Max Fletcher was the other one that I knew, and myself. None of us made it that way, but we did later on to Navy V-12 officer training.
But at that point, you didn't. So you were with this small group, and you were on the USS Oklahoma for how long?
18 months I served on it. I did all sorts of duty on it. They put you into a deck division right away. The 4th Division was where I was. And that was an interesting experience. You maintained the ship, for one thing. Your battle station was down in the powder in the handling room for the 14-inch guns, and where you carried a 100-pound bag of powder around. 100? I think it was 50. But then what happened was that the fellow that slept over me, he had three bunks high, and I slept in the you get the bottom locker, you get the bottom bunk, and cigarette ashes sometimes come down on you. But the fellow that slept over me, he had mess cooking for a yeoman's group. He jumped ship. He didn't want to go into with the Navy. This was before the war broke out, and the boatswain's mate asked me if I'd like to get my mess cooking over with. I said yes. I was mess cooking for a week and a half to the yeoman's mess, and the captain's yeoman comes to me and he says, "Do you know how to type?" I said, "Yes." "How would you like to be a striker in the captain's office?" And that's a trainee in the captain's office. I said, "Fine." So all of a sudden I go from down below three decks up to the top of the ship, cross the corridor from the captain's office, and then my battle station then was up in the office. I could look out and for the first time and see the 16-inch or the 14-inch guns firing in exercises.
You only saw them below before, and now you could actually
see
them.
Now I'm right up to the top. So sure. From the bottom right up to the top.
And where did you go from there?
From there, I went to the communications office. I ended up with what was called cellulitis of my left lower leg, and it was in the vicinity of where I had hurt my leg playing football. And they had me back and forth. They finally sent me over to the USS Relief, where they gave me a minute and 22 seconds of X-ray every other day for a few days. And that seemed to cure it for the time being.
Was but USS Relief like a hospital ship?
That was a hospital ship.
Mm-hmm. And you were there for a few days, and then did you go back on to?
Morris Hare, who was the yeoman, the captain's yeoman that invited me up to the captain's office, he thought I was going to be in there for a while, and so he hired a fellow named George Sleater to take my place. So what they did then was to send me to the communications office outside the radio room. And that's where I typed that miraculous message that got me off the ship.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned you were in Pearl Harbor. You were on the Oklahoma, you said, for 18 months. And during that time period, what was happening worldwide?
What was happening was that they were preparing for war. You would have the battleships steaming in formation, both day and night. And you'd have the destroyers screening for the ships. And then you would have planes, our own planes, trying to break up that formation and drop dummy torpedoes. And you would have the ship's captain then trying to dodge, exercising, trying to dodge those torpedoes. And so that was kind of the atmosphere that led up to Pearl Harbor, and it didn't really come as a big surprise to me when it happened.
And how did you hear about, or did you have any, were you in Pearl Harbor actually when all of this occurred?
When all this took place, see, the fleet was based out there in 1940, and so that was, and then the exercises continued on there.
So you were now in Pearl Harbor.
In Pearl Harbor from early 1940, and I left out there in April of 1943. April 1943 to come back to V-12 officer training.
So tell me about being in Pearl Harbor. You were on the USS Oklahoma still?
I wasn't there that morning, on board the ship that morning. I was on a midnight watch.
Talk about that. Tell us about that.
That Saturday, December the 6th, they had a Battle of the Bands at Richardson Recreation Center. Now that was a brand new building just outside the Navy Yard fence and adjacent to the Navy housing, family housing. So I went to the Battle of the Bands. The USS Oklahoma played there. I'd already been transferred to the communications office at Pearl Harbor, at the main office there. And So then I left there and I got just a few winks of sleep, and then I walked down to the communications office at the the main building, where everything where the admiral was and this whole thing. And I was on duty then from 12 o'clock midnight on till 7 o'clock the next morning.
So this is December 6, 1941?
This is December the 6, 1941, mm-hmm. into December the 7th, 41. And long about 5 minutes of 7, we had a message from the USS Ward saying they had fired on and dropped depth charges on an unidentified submarine operating in a restricted area at the mouth of the harbor. Now, that was the first shot fired in the war, right, December the 7th. Supposedly, the strategy was to be that we would not fire the first shot. But we did, and it should have been fired, I think. But I typed the message up and handed it to the communications officer. And then I was relieved by my relief to come so I could walk back to the receiving station, shower, breakfast, turn in. I had no sooner turned in on the top floor. And this was about 5 minutes of 8.
So the top floor of a building, not in the ship. You were on land?
I was on land. That was from April of 1941 when I got the message, and my commanding officer let me have it, let me have the transfer. That's why I say my whole thing, I couldn't have planned it any better. I knew my mother was praying for me for one thing. And she has an iron cross on the Grace Methodist that's been put on the outside of the Grace Methodist Church in Carbondale, Illinois, in her honor because of her activity.
Now, you were off duty and you were catching some sleep.
I hadn't even had a chance to get to sleep when this awful noise of planes approaching came.
And were they low?
They were low, flying, carrying one torpedo. They had two canopies, two pilots. You could see their faces. You could see the goggles they had on. Now, they were coming in low. They had to come in low to drop the torpedoes. Now, they were using our building as a marshaling point in their path. Because that particular point, and you would see it on the picture here, was where they had the most expanse of water to deal with that went into the ship, and it was such that it angled right towards the USS Oklahoma. And the USS Oklahoma took about 8 torpedoes and capsized in 12 minutes.
And this was your former ship.
Pardon?
This was your former ship.
My former ship. 3 of my buddies that were in the communications office went down with the ship. 429 total went down with the ship, including 14 Marines.
When you heard all of this noise, did you go outside and view what was happening?
I ran to the window. I'm on the top floor. Here come the planes in. I didn't stay to count them. But I read later there were 40 of them. And then you'd go to the back of the building, look down on the harbor. You could see them dropping their torpedoes, and you could see the USS Arizona blowing sky high, and the other ships taking the torpedoes and the bombs.
When you saw this, and I'm assuming it's very clear to you still today, what was your feeling? Were you frightened? Were you angry? Were you in shock? What was your feeling?
I don't think you had time to be frightened or in shock. I think the training that you got in the Navy, the discipline you got, I think that was comforting. My first thought was if I could get a gun, even as poor a shot as I might be, I could accidentally maybe shoot down a plane. Then I would get a big medal. Not that that was important. But I went down to the basement where I knew the guns were. Things were locked up. I couldn't do a thing with it. I came back upstairs, walked out to the front of the building. Here was a group forming around an officer. And I stayed at the edge of that group and separated myself from them and went across the street and across a little narrow gauge railroad that brought pineapples through the Navy Yard and across the baseball diamond that I knew, that I was very familiar with. I knew there was a ditch in the outfield along the chain link fence that separated the Navy Yard from the Navy housing. I got down in that ditch, and that's where I was when the next wave of high bombers came in some 20 minutes later.
Did others follow you and go into the ditch also, or were you by yourself?
No, I was by myself.
Mm-hmm. What was your sense then? What were you feeling then?
Well, I was thinking, boy, this is, for one thing, I could see the planes, high altitude planes coming in, and you could see the silver slivers of the bombs they were dropping, angling down towards the Navy Yard. And of course, your first thought was, I wonder how close that is to me. But it was in the Navy Yard, which was about 3/4 of a mile away. And my main thought was, oh boy, this is going to be a long war. Will I ever see my parents and my brothers and sister again?
What was the noise level like?
The noise level was that of approaching planes. Where it was close and where it was low, it was very heavy.
How long did it last?
How long did it last? I read that it lasted only about 4 hours. 4 hours? No, it was only 2 hours, really, because they came in fast, it was over with, and then about 40 minutes later, something like that, while the high-altitude bombers came over. And, of course, the first other thoughts that you had was, boy, if they had a landing force, why, they could take over the island. So they really missed the boat on that. They missed the boat on not bombing the oil tanks that were around there. They missed the boat on not bombing the repair facilities that they had. But they had tunnel vision for the large capital ships. And this was to give them some feeling that they could go on down the coast from Japan there to gain raw materials from the other countries, this kind of thing.
When you're in the ditch, how far away are you from the battleships, from the Arizona and
from the Arizona and all, about a mile.
And you could see the smoke and the flames?
You could see it. That harbor, if you've been out there, you can see it's very small. It's a very small harbor. And you can go up into the mountains and the Japanese were taking pictures from it. They could take them very easily and know just where the ships were.
So you say only 2 hours, but for you, what did it feel like time-wise?
It seemed like time had no meaning. That afternoon, I'm down in the where they feed everyone, where the dining facilities were, and there's a long string of oil-soaked sailors coming into that Mary's Point ship's landing. They would come in there going on liberty, walk up past our building, and go to the gate to Honolulu, which at that time was between Hickam Field and the Navy housing. It's been shifted more towards the submarine base now, today. But the oil-soaked sailors would come in through the basement, discard their oil, their clothes. You could see the whites of their teeth. That was about it before they went into the shower. They'd get clean clothes. They'd come upstairs, and all around the dining room was signs posted on the wall with the names of the ships on them. So as the survivors came in, they would sign in. And that's the way, one way they had of telling who had survived the attack.
So you were in that room also?
Yes.
Were you looking for some of your buddies?
Well, Max Fletcher, my friend that stayed with that group, ended up in a firefighting party down on the docks where the Pennsylvania, battleship Pennsylvania, and two destroyers, the Cassin and the Downs, were in dry dock upon wooden blocks. And to fight fires, yeah, a bomb fell before they could even seek shelter down there. I was visiting Max Fletcher that afternoon in the hospital where he was in with a seriously burned fellows. He was lucky. It only singed his eyebrows and blistered his face. They wore dungarees and skivvy shirts as uniform of the day at that time, but where bare flesh was, it was blistered by the flare from that bomb. I read later that if I had been down there and not got aboard it, I could have got killed very easily.
How did that make you feel that you were so fortunate to be in the right place when all of this occurred?
I just felt something was looking over me.
How long was Max in the hospital for?
I don't know. He wasn't in there very long because he could heal very quickly. The others, they were just bare flesh. They couldn't stand clothes on. And they were sprayed with some kind of spray. I just read what it was, and I can't remember what it was, but it left them looking like a brown, almost like a brown crust, but I guess it kept the air from irritating their bodies, I don't know.
So the next day, what were your duties?
That evening, should I mention that?
Sure.
That evening was a total blackout because they still thought that the Japanese might come in. And I made it a point not to be out after dark because of the prospect of some seaman yelling halt and you're not hearing it, then you could be shot. So I was down in the communications office and all along about 9 o'clock, we got this alert, planes coming in. And what guns could open up, opened up. And they shot down four of our own planes from the USS Enterprise. So that's called friendly fire. But I'm under my desk when that was going on.
In talking to some of your peers during that time period, that day, that night, were you all concerned? Were you afraid? Were you anxious as to what was going to happen? And especially having the 9 o'clock alert. Do you remember talking about it to your friends?
No, not really. About the only time you'd get an indication would be when some officer would show up with his revolver on that something was about to happen, but that didn't happen very often. It did happen during the Battle of Midway in June, when we actually won the war in June in the Battle of Midway.
But getting back to your experience, what happened, for instance, within the week after the bombing of Pearl Harbor? What was your day like?
Well, it was still at the communications office, taking my regular tour of 8 hours there. And my main concern was trying to get word to my mother and father that I was not hurt in it. And 8 days later, I managed to get into Honolulu and send a telegram saying, "Am well, letter follows." And that changed the complexion back in Carbondale, Illinois.
And in fact, after the fact, speaking with your family, what was it like for them waiting to hear from you?
I'm the eldest of seven children. I have one sister. She's a retired Methodist minister in Evansville, Indiana, currently retired, building a home for recovering alcoholic women that want to get off of alcohol and drugs. I think my dad probably took it worse than...
Not knowing.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk about your experiences with them when you got home?
I've talked about it with them. I don't remember too much other than they were very, very concerned.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay in Pearl Harbor? You mentioned earlier.
I stayed at Pearl Harbor until about, was it April? I think it was April of 1943 that the Navy V-12 officer training originated. The government was interested in training officers in a hurry for landing craft duty in case it had to be used in Japan.
And that's what you went after, the V-12 training?
And I went after that, and so they sent me back to St. Ambrose College in Davenport, Iowa, and I was there for 4 semesters, and because I was supposedly an old salt, why they made me battalion commander for 2 semesters, which was a lot of fun.
And when they say an old salt, how old were you?
Pardon?
When you mentioned that they considered you an old salt, how old were you at that time?
At Pearl Harbor?
No, when you were back in Iowa in training.
Back in Iowa, let's see, that was 43 from 21. What's that, 22?
You were 22 years old. Did a lot of your other officers in training talk to you about your experience in Pearl Harbor?
By miraculous, because I put on the web, I had a call from San Francisco from a fellow named Fletcher. And he said, "I was playing around with the web and I came across your mentioning my father, Max Fletcher." I said, "I've been trying to catch up with him ever since I left the Navy, because we played tennis together out at Kapi'olani Park out there and went swimming at Waikiki and at the Waikiki Theater and all that." He says, so he clued me in on his father, and his father had become a professor at the University of Idaho in economics. And I said, "Where were you when all this when it first started?" He said, "I was on top of the building." And he said, "I could wave to the pilots, as the Japanese pilots, as they came by." But he was the one that came downstairs and got in on that firefighting party. I always felt a little hesitant about talking about that because, what were you, a coward? You know? But then it turned out it was the best thing that could happen.
Sure.
So I don't mind talking about it now.
Sure, yeah. Have you been back to Pearl Harbor since?
About 3 times. 3 times I've been back.
What's it like for you when you go back there?
Well, I still enjoy the aroma of the flowers and the ocean. And I don't know, a lot of people want to go to Europe. I'd rather go to Hawaii.
What about seeing some of the artifacts, the Arizona or some of the memorials? What's that like for you?
Some years ago, I wrote a letter to the the officer, day officer out at Pearl Harbor, telling him I was there. He was interested in writing as much of a story as he could, so he wanted to talk with me. So he invited me as his guest out there. And so on a Memorial Day, this has been about 20 years or so ago, he invited my brother and I. My brother was in the Pacific in all sorts of action, where I only had the one day. But then looking at all those names and being aboard that monument, which is placed midship across the Arizona, and the only thing that bothered me was the movie that they put on before, which talked about the brilliant Japanese attack. And a friend of mine that lives out at on Oahu there made it a point to watch carefully what was taking place out there, and in fact trying to identify some of the bodies that were picked up that morning. He has succeeded in at least one, but that's a major thing. But he went after the Forest Service on that. He said it wasn't a brilliant attack, it was a sneak attack. And so he got them to either take that out or change it. So.
Do you speak a lot at different groups? I know prior to our taping today, you mentioned speaking at some high schools and other areas.
Yes, John Tershenich, who is the veterans agent over in Wayland, gave me the opportunity to talk to some of the school kids over there. And I enjoyed that because it's so vivid in my memory, and maybe it can be of some benefit to them. I also have spoken twice at the historical presentations over in the Weston Library over there. They had me on twice because they wanted another group to come in on it. Shortly after that, I was invited to speak up at Amherst College to the alumni for their holiday up there. And so I prepared a presentation for that with the help of a good friend. I've also been interviewed out at our Oklahoma City reunions for the Oklahoma survivors. And then just recently Wentworth High School, I don't know whether it was high school or college, I think it's college. He interviewed me over in Wayland for a project that Wentworth is starting on this. This was just about 3 months ago.
Getting back to your career after Pearl Harbor, you mentioned going to officer's training. Where did that take you?
First, it took me to San Ambrose College for 4 semesters.
Right.
Then it took me to Fort Schuyler Midshipman School, which is in the Bronx, New York City, up near Whitestone Bridge. A very cold winter of 1944 and 45. And I graduated in St. John's Divine Cathedral in New York City in the first class in March the 3rd, I believe, 1945. Then I had a choice at that time. Like I say, they were angling to get officers for landing craft duty. But they gave me a choice. I could either go to the Navy Supply Corps school at the Harvard Business School or go to amphibious training in Florida. What do you think I took? I took the Harvard Business School. And so the war came to an end when I was there. And that's when I had met Rosalie, entered a dance in on Beacon Street there. and we were married October the 20th, 1945. Yeah.
So you had a nice long life with her.
Yeah.
So you finished up at Harvard Business School. That took you a few years?
That was a special course.
Mm-hmm.
That lasted from, from April till till August. And we were married in October.
And then where did you go?
Well, we lived off of her parents Riverdale Road, Wellesley, for about 4 months, and I said, well, finally, we've got to do something. So Rosalie suggested that, she says, why don't you finish your education? Where should I go? She said, a high school friend of mine went to Amherst College. She says, why don't you try them?
Now, were you already retired from the Navy at that point?
Yes. Like I was to the Naval Reserve, so I went in once in a while to Boston.
So then you applied for school at Amherst College?
At Amherst College, and they accepted me with the other veterans up there. It's a good thing I went then because under the GI Bill, because people have a problem going there now.
But you were able to get an education under the GI Bill.
Yeah, I got my... I graduated there in June 1947, and I'm the class secretary of the class of 1947, and I've had it for about 17 years, and I've been trying to get somebody else to take it.
They know a good thing, don't they? They're not going to give up. Yeah, what was your major when you graduated?
History. I always enjoyed history. They came out in my class, mostly lawyers and doctors out there, and I discovered that the reason for doctors was Professor Chaté that got them all enthusiastic to become doctors. They mentioned him.
And what did you do with your history major?
I had some jobs lined up. Selling marble for the Vermont Marble Company for, $45 a week. I ended up taking a management training job for W.T. Grant Company in Boston. And I stayed with them for 2.5 years and then decided one day to go in to see the district manager, Mr. Hawes. And I said, Mr. Hawes, I said, no college graduate in his right mind would work for W.T. Grant Company. And he wanted to know what I thought was wrong, and I told him. And I was told later on after I left that it made some changes in the company. Of course, they're not in business now.
Sure. But they took what you said seriously and made the changes.
But he threw a red flag in front of me. He said, you know, jobs are scarce right now. You have trouble getting a job. Well, that summer I bandied 3 jobs back and forth and missed out on all 3 of them. Went out to General Motors and saw the manager out there. Usually I can remember his name, but he said, well, we don't have anything in the office right now, but he said, if you want to go out on the line, work out there, he said, I'll give the first job it opens up, I'll give you a chance at it. So I'm out on the shipping line out there scraping paint and everything off the windows. It was a tough job, but it was nice manual labor.
And how long did you stay with General Motors?
I stayed with General Motors about 1.5 years. And then I went with Raytheon Company. The first job I was a job of taking care of the budgets, taking care of the reports on what we had completed, and this sort of thing. I stayed with them 35 years, and I retired in 1980, 89, so I've had 20 years of retirement a lot of people don't have.
Now, you had mentioned that you continued on in the Naval Reserve.
Did I what?
Continued on in the Naval Reserve.
Yes.
Were you called up at all during that time?
No, but I would have been called up in Korea, and I would have to left my family. I would have had to leave my job. And so I asked to be separated from the service. That has caused me to lose any benefits that I might have got, any pension or what have you. In fact, I could get into the Hanscom Field, and Rosalie and I could go in there and dine at Hanscom Field. We couldn't go to the ship service or anything like that, but at least we could do that. And then when 9/11 came along, why, all of a sudden, they barred me from going into Hanscom Field, and I've had some resentment there because I've been cleared for secret by Raytheon, and I've run schools for the pilots that we invited back to find out about the missile. And I worked with the State Department in export-import licensing for the missile, this kind of things. And I've ran hospitality parties, and I've even put three launchers and a Hawk in the inaugural parade for John F. Kennedy with the help of the Army there. And I had a call back from the Army at Cameron Station there saying that we were sorry, the Hawk launcher came loose from the truck that was towing it and went into a ditch. I said the right thing. I said, didn't anybody get hurt? I got a commendation for that.
Oh, my. Did you join any veterans organizations after your service or after leaving the Naval Reserve?
I really wasn't a joiner. I get the impression that they like to have their own organization. I'm sorry, I see it everywhere. You just get the feeling, yes, you're invited, but no, you're not.
Okay. You did mention that you've attended some of the Oklahoma reunions.
I've attended quite a few of the Oklahoma reunions, yeah, different places, but the last 3 years has been in Oklahoma City. And there, they opened their arms really for us and interrupted the state legislature to let five of us talk. And you can see I'm not sure to talk. What was happening then was we were having trouble getting a place to put a monument out at Pearl Harbor for the 429 guys that died out there. They're the only ones that don't have a monument out there. So this last December the 7th, I had a call from a friend of mine who attended. He said, we got a place close to the USS Missouri. Now, to place the monument there. But one of the things that the Forest Service was using as an excuse not to put it there was that it might set an example for, and they'd have to do it for all the other ships. And to the legislature, I said, you know, the Arizona had some 1,100 die that morning. The Oklahoma had 429 that died. No other ship is even close to the casualties that the Oklahoma suffered. And hopefully it had some effect, I don't know.
How important to you was serving in the military, and in what ways did it affect your life?
Serving in the military, you got exposed to what you could do if you made up your mind to do it, and I think that's it, if you made up your mind to do it. Because that you all of a sudden discovered you could do a lot of things that you didn't think you could do.
So it gave you a little bit of self-confidence, is that what I'm hearing?
I think it gave you a lot of self-confidence. And that's what I had, I think, that morning. I don't think I was scared. I know I was looking for whatever I could do, this kind of thing. But I think it trains you to be reliant. I mean, you learn to live out of a small locker. One little story, if you want to hear about the locker, when I first went aboard the ship, you get the bottom of everything, and later on, while you graduate to the second bunk or the top bunk or the top locker, but everything you own is in that little locker. I come in with a new sea bag right out of training, and I start unloading it, and this big, strong, burly arm reaches over my shoulder, and he reaches in and he gets my pea coat. He says, "Boy, this is a beautiful coat. I think I'll take it." Something told me not to pay any attention to him, which I did. And finally, he saw he wasn't going to get my goat, so to speak. So he gave it back to me. Well, this is a guy named Roberts. He and I became good friends, but we would never go ashore together. But, you know, he was the one guy that, as when the ship capsized, was strong enough to swim down where the ship had capsized, swim that way, and swim up, and let the Navy Yard workers know where 32 guys were in waiting to be rescued. And they cut through the hull the next day and got them out.
So he's quite a hero. Above all, is there one thought or an incident that you'd like to share with us or with your family who will be getting a copy of this when they see the tape?
My brothers and my sister, the one thing I would say is that if I had chosen, my brothers and my sister I couldn't have chosen it any better.
Well, that's a very thoughtful thing to say. I'm sure they'd be thrilled to hear that. Thank you, Gerald Lee Halterman, for your participation in this program today. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah.